You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with
Karen G. Lloyd, author of Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth.
This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
It's really changed my view of sort of what life is. You know, so many of the things that we attribute, the trappings of life, are that they look like requirements, like oxygen, sunlight, all the things that we would absolutely, all humans would die if we didn't get access to those things. They're not necessary really for life. And studying these things sort of breaks down, well, what is necessary? What are the things that life has to have? And what we see are energies. You know, that's a really big defining feature of life, is that it has to be continually bathed in some sort of energy that has to be flowing through it at all times. And that requirement sort of opens our eyes to other possible ways that life can be. You know, we just always study them in this active growing state. And so since these organisms are by and large things that have never grown in lab, their whole lineages are not laboratory organisms, I'd love to know how long a single cell can last, because if it is possible that a single cell can last for hundreds of thousands of years, I just think that's a weird way for biology to be.
As implied in the term intraterrestrial, I mean, how linked is that to extraterrestrial? In that, I mean, we do eat, like, even us, the fact that our planet is alive and we're alive. I mean, are we all from outer space? Or, you know, what, you know, because they're, particularly when further down you go, some of that stuff is really alien.
I mean, that's why I'm using that word, is that I want to draw the similarities with alien life. And we have these questions. They're the same questions that we would be asking if we could get a sample from Europa or we could get a sample from Mars. So I think that the parallels are partly in how we study them. So they're teaching us how to go about looking for strange life. But then they're also teaching us about what's possible with life. And they're so close to the edge of what is and isn't life that it really helps us to sort of, I don't know where to draw that line personally, but they at least show us that that line is maybe closer to non-life than we would have thought, than I would have thought.
I know this isn't part of what you're studying, but I just have to geek out about diatoms for a second. And these are these tiny single-celled organisms. They live in water in our oceans, are super small, but they make their own food from sunlight, kind of like plants do. And what's wild is that their cells are wrapped in these beautiful glass-like shells made of silica. And some of them look like they were designed by aliens. I mean, super intricate patterns. And they're also super important for life in the ocean because they're a major food source for everything from plankton to whales. But they also help us breathe. I guess diatoms produce something like 20 to 30% of the oxygen in our atmosphere. So yeah, every few breaths you take, you can thank a diatom, I think. And they also pull carbon dioxide out of the air. And when they die, their silica cells stick around, useful in everything from animal feed to gut health products. There's even research into how they can help regulate our microbiome. So tiny creatures, massive impact, totally underrated.
Of course, now we've been discovering more and more about our microbiomes and understand that we are not, like, are we really the thoughts that we think? Or, you know, that's influenced by our actual gut and all the things living on and in us. There's so many wonderful things in the world that we can't see. We just happen to see the ones that we're attuned to.
Maybe people remember taking a biology class when they were kids and learning about mitochondria, but that's a type of organelle that's inside almost all of our cells, but it is the powerhouse of the cell. So that's the part of the cell that takes oxygen and uses it to make energy. That mitochondrion is an ancient bacterium. It's on a lineage from a bacterium. It was an alpha proteobacteria. And so we, in our cells, not our guts, you know, you can kind of envision our digestive system as like kind of open to the world. We take things in and we let things out. So we're kind of like shaped like a donut, right? We've got a hole in the middle that we send food through and process it. We also have the parts that are like us, right? Like inside our skin itself, our organs, our blood, those things inside those cells that are truly us. There's even a little ancient bacterium inside those cells too, which I think is really mind-blowing.
And so I'm wondering, we're talking about climate change, and now in America, the Trump presidency, they're climate deniers, or they want to slow the mitigation of climate change. And I believe this is a crucial decade. Has that affected your funding, your research?
It's been weird. It's unprecedented. I've never had a situation where the executive branch has exerted so much control over spending, which I always understood to be Congress's role. So yeah, it's affecting everything. I think right now it's kind of in limbo because it seems like some of the choices, like for instance, the newest stuff that came out of is going to be required to basically we write a competitive grant to the NSF and we get awarded a fund. You know, it's very hard to get those grants, actually. You're very, very lucky if you can convince your peers that you're doing something good. The things that get funded are truly fantastic science. Only the best of the best gets funded. The NSF is just set up to only reward really, really fantastic science. So that's how the system was working. And the way the grants work is that if you get a grant to your university or your institution, there's a portion of that grant that has to go to the upkeep of your laboratory. You know, just like being able to do the lab work that you do requires an institutional financial investment in what you're doing. It's like rent. You have to pay rent to be there. So universities have a system set up where they have a certain percentage that they pull out, and it's usually about 50% of the grant, which it seems like a lot of money, but that's how the process works, and it's how we keep the lights on. It's how we keep going. And the NSF has recently declared that no university or research institution will be able to take more than 15% in overhead. You know, it's like taking the city of San Francisco and saying, no one's going to pay rent over $100 a month. And then as a renter, you can say, woohoo, like this is great rent, no worries. But can you imagine what the apartments would be like if landlords are only getting $100 rent? Like, they're not going to be places you want to live. You can't really sustain a building for that in San Francisco. So that is the most recent thing that has happened. The question is, will it stick? One of the things that we are being asked to do as scientists now by the Trump administration is to not do DEI, to not try to expand access of science to people who wouldn't normally get access to science. I'm from rural North Carolina. I'm from Trump land, very rural coastal North Carolina. And the universities have some research stations in my hometown or around my hometown. And they always did outreach to kids who don't have access. And I was one of those kids. You know, I would do their outreach programs as a kid, go to a mud flat and see what kind of creepy crawlies were crawling through the mud. And it absolutely is the reason that I'm a scientist today. You know, I don't have a time in conscious life where I didn't know what a scientist was, because I always knew them because they did this outreach stuff with me. So that stuff has to continue. But then I've had other amazing mentors all throughout my career. I did my undergraduate at Swarthmore College and I majored in biochemistry and my research was in biophysical chemistry. And I had this wonderful mentor, Kathleen Howard. I was like, Kathleen, I love what we're doing. I love the intellectual challenge of chemistry. I want to keep doing it for graduate school in my career, but I want to do it in a jungle. It's just like, I don't know, Karen. I don't know how to do this in a jungle. I can't direct you anywhere. I don't even know what you're talking about. But if you find it, I'll write you a recommendation for it. I'll support you wherever you go. She was very supportive. It was great. One of the things that I would not know about had I not gone to as many places as I have is how much the people in the landscape are intertwined. You know, everywhere I go, I'm working with people who are already there, whether their lineage has been there for thousands of years or whether they're recently arrived. The urge to be a scientist, no matter what your political state is or what your funding state is always going to be there. So everywhere we go are scientists. And so it's the natural world is amazing and it is a miracle. I think it's amazing, but it is intertwined in the local people as well. And that's been really wonderful to see.
We hope you've enjoyed this program and listening to the highlights of this podcast. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast or learn more about environmental projects, click on the subscribe button. Thank you for listening.